So what I want to do today is too much. I want to introduce the very basics of superconducting qubits. And I want to save some time at the end for outlining what I think are today's important questions in quantum information processing and to think about where there's key contributions that need to be made today to try to convince you that maybe you want to make some of those. But let's start with superconductivity. And you've seen that we can build quantum devices. But for the most part, the Hamiltonians that we're using are some interaction frame version of the Hamiltonians nature gives us. I mean, we end up being close to atomic and molecular physics in these. And certainly with the neutron work, you could say that we're engineering something more, but in fact that the controls that we're using are the same on interactions. We don't actually use, there is scattering and diffraction, but we don't use it as a knob, right? And the nice thing about the superconducting world is that we can make perhaps a wider range of the fundamental Hamiltonians directly. Now, of course, in the interaction frames, everything is universal, right? So the whole point of having a quantum computer is that you shouldn't need to know what's in there once it's working. And that whether it's built from superconductors or photons or spins, from the user's point of view, it should all look the same. But if you're building it yourself, you're going to pay attention to those details. So, of course, superconductivity has been around a long time, right? That since Kamerling-Onnes could liquefy helium at the early years of last century, then his group discovered superconductivity in mercury. And already, of course, it was a going piece. Now, took a long, long, long time for a theory of superconductivity to be realized. But that the resistance went to zero was early. And there was a famous, nice experiment that says, okay, let me take a ring. And I hope you've looked at, on your way to a hydrogen atom, the wave function for an electron confined to a ring and seen that it has a very simple form. And of course, if I have a wave function confined to a ring, we want the wave function to be single-valued. We want it to be continuous. And so we're going to pick up integer multiples of 2 pi phase over the ring, right? And so we have a quantized ring with number of loops of 2 pi. And I'm going to skip all of the details because I'll never get through it if I don't skip all the details. But the next stuff is more interesting anyways. And so we could say, well, what's the total phase going around the ring? And the total phase going around the ring is quantized as n over Planck, n times Planck's constant over e. And n here, of course, can take on integer values, one increasing. It can't be zero, of course. And this model works as long as transports is ballistic. So I hope you know that if you have any metal, just about, that if you get short enough, something below 80 nanometers, transports is ballistic, that the electrons don't scatter. And if I take graphene, and I have good, high-quality graphene, then we can have transport that's longer than that in ballistic. If I cool materials, I can have transport that's ballistic. And so we can make devices that behave exactly like this. But if we make a superconductor, make a superconducting ring, and of course the superconducting ring is ballistic, because the point of having a superconductor is that the Cooper pairs don't scatter, then we find this factor of two here. This was the first clear indication that, in fact, we have Cooper pairs. And you know, Cooper pairs arise from the phonon modes, from transport being coupled to phonon modes. And that, of course, you can also see from the types of materials that become superconductors, right? That a lousy conductor may become a good superconductor. A good conductor will rarely become a good superconductor because, of course, to have a good conductor, then the electron's not connected very well with phonon modes. Okay, that's the first hour of the lecture. Now we move on. So now we've gone from 1911 to 1950, and we go to the 60s. And Brian Josephson makes the startling comment that Cooper pairs must really exist. Okay? The rest of the physics follows from that. And of course, as with a lot of new physics, the people putting forth the ideas of the new physics don't necessarily believe that it's right. And so Brian looks at what's called now a Josephson junction, but it is just a tunneling junction of a superconductor. And so you can imagine having two aluminum leads and placing aluminum oxide, a thin layer of aluminum oxide, which is an insulator, between them. Now, aluminum oxide is a wonderful material because when it oxidizes, it expands. And so when you build an oxide layer from aluminum, it's very easy to have a thin layer that has no defects. And of course, if you're looking at tunneling, if there's a defect and so you have a small area that you have real transport through, you're dead, right? Okay. And so he has this. We'll forget about the behavior. And so what Brian says is that the tunneling current is going to be tunneling of Cooper pairs, that the condensant is going to tunnel through, and that in tunneling through, there'll be a current that depends upon the phase difference over the junction. And so it's nice to come back here and say, oh, imagine I put the junction there. And this cross is the electric symbol for Josephson junction. Okay. And then, you know, here, of course, you would say, oh, that we've broken the ring with this junction weakens the quantization condition. And so now then, I'm allowed to have a phase jump of the wave function over that break, right? And now we have this phase. Now here, it's important to think about, I think, this from today's point of view. Because one of the things that Brian's advisor failed to see, so Brian was a PhD student at the time. His advisor, Brian Pippard, said, no, this isn't going to work. That what happens is that in the insulator, you'll break Cooper pairs and you'll have tunneling of individual events. And so the probability of having a Cooper pair tunneling is the square of the tunneling probability, which says, okay, I'm going to take something which is zero and square it, and it'll be bloody close to zero. And Bardeen agreed with Pippard. But in retrospect, you know, it's easy to say, well, no way, right? Because the wave function can't change quickly. And today, as we're trying to build new materials, so if you come over, when you came over to the lab and you saw the Omicron tool, the point of that Omicron tool is to make a material and to place on top of it another material with an incompatible wave function. But we know that wave functions can't change instantaneously. And so the wave function must leak into the other material. And superconductivity is such a strong effect that the superconductivity is going to leak into the insulator. And so what you would think here, as Brian did, is to say, oh yes, I'm going to have a supercurrent that flows through this insulator. So the insulator, this tunneling junction, is going to behave like a tunneling junction if you had electrons. But if I have Cooper pairs, then it's going to behave as though we simply have a current. And so the experiment from this, the so-called DC Josephson effect, says take your junction, send a current into it, and measure the voltage across it. And the voltage across it is zero. And the current is set only by this phase. And so here, I should connect those. Here we'll have a weak link, which normally we would think to be very, very resistive. And yet, out of this weak link, we'll get a supercurrent. So, no voltage. We have a current. And the current is set by the phase of the difference across the junction of the wave function. We use language that says, oh yes, there must be something that looks coherent across this piece. Now I sub C is the so-called critical current. And it depends on the material we use, it depends upon the width of the insulator, it depends upon the way we construct the device. And so this, for any device we're looking at, is just a constant. So now then I could say, oh yes, I can take and control the phase. You always say, well, how do I control the phase? You can control the phase by putting in another Josephson junction and putting a voltage across it. Or I can control the phase by threading this with a magnetic field. Right, so we can control the phase. As we control the phase, we get a current, and the current will be a superconducting current. The second piece that he said was that the time rate of change of the phase is equal to the voltage. So this is a voltage across the Josephson junction. So clearly, in this case, there's no voltage. So the time rate of change of the phase is zero, right? It's just constant. But that piece leads to the so-called AC Josephson effect. I put a voltage, and I now am going to put an ammeter in here. So we're going to measure the current. We'll add a Josephson junction. Okay, so we know that from the second equation, d phi dt is equal to twice e over h bar times v. So that phi is going to be 2e over h bar v times t. So the phase is going to be a linear function of time. But the phase sets the current. Okay? And so the current is going to oscillate. And the oscillation frequency, you know, these are just fundamental constants here. So the oscillation frequency is 4.8 times 10 to the 14. Now that's a very strange phenomenon, right? You say, okay, I'm going to take a circuit, which is an open circuit, and I'm going to see a supercurrent flowing through. And then over here you say, I'm going to take a circuit element, I'm going to apply a DC voltage to it, and I'll see a DC voltage, but the current will oscillate in time. And so Brian had lots of people lining up to tell him he was an idiot. And there was a famous set of talks at the British something, I forget what it was, some conference, 1962. Where Brian and Bardeen, you know, sitting at PI, you know, of course, Bardeen wins two Nobel Prizes, is a great man, and he is, are both giving talks. Brian speaks first, and then Bardeen speaks and says, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, and that everything is really tied right here, that there's no supercurrent, there's no Cooper pairs in an insulator. And fortunately, it's an easy experiment to do. Really easy today, not so hard then. And Roel and Phil Anderson, who was then at Bell Labs, did experiment and quickly was replicated in many, many other labs to show that, in fact, this is exactly what happens. So then Brian can go on and win the Nobel Prize. He doesn't even have to share it with his advisor. Okay. So now then, we go and we look a little bit more deeply into a Josephson junction. And so a Josephson junction is a little bit more completely modeled as a capacitor or Josephson junction in a resistor all in parallel. And a capacitor, because we're actually making a parallel plate capacitor to have some tunnel area. A resistor, because there's a leakage current, and of course, if you look at the current that's flowing through the junction, well, there's a critical current, and above the critical current, right, you're going to have tunneling that's a normal state tunneling, right? You'll have quasi-particles. So what you end up with is this nice element of a circuit. So RC Josephson junction. And let's go ahead and calculate things. So we know that the current through the junction is the critical current. So sorry about the nomenclature, but that's critical. And that, of course, the current through the resistor is just given by Ohm's law. We know that V is equal to H bar over 2E d phi dt. And so that the current is H bar over 2E. And we can also solve for the critical current, and the critical current like so. So now if I take and make a circuit out of this, so I'm going to drive this with a DC current. And we'll just add up all the currents going around. Then IDC is going to be so now I end up with a second order differential equation for the current in this device. Okay? So this is my drive, of course. And we would say, oh yeah, this looks like I have a harmonic oscillator, right? Looks like I have a driven harmonic oscillator. And so then if I look at my driven harmonic oscillator, then I would say that the natural frequency of this and the damping of it is is 1 over RC, right? So that we can describe this as a harmonic oscillator. And this is going to be where we take off to build a quantum device. If I have a quantum device, then I'd like to find a few energy levels that I can say, oh, there's my qubit. Okay? And if we have a harmonic oscillator, then we think we should find a few levels. And since it's a driven harmonic oscillator, it'll have some nonlinearities in this. And so life will be good, right? We don't want a purely harmonic potential. Okay. So what do we do? So if I want this to be coherent, I better choose IDC to be less than the critical current, right? Because otherwise I'm going to break Cooper pairs. So we choose that to be less than the critical current. And then sine phi is going to be IDC over the critical current. And of course, remember what happens now. If I set IDC to be below the critical current, then here I've got current flowing through the Josephson junction. And remember the DC Josephson effect, that the voltage across that is zero. So therefore, the Josephson junction has shorted out the device. And so there better be no current flowing through the resistor or the capacitor. Yeah? Okay. And so then we can plot up. I'm going to do it over here. So I'm going to look at the voltage on this axis, but remember that although we've shorted out the device, the voltage we're going to see, if we ever see a voltage, has to be an oscillating voltage, right? That's the AC Josephson effect. Okay, so when I plot voltage over here, although I'm applying a DC current, this is going to be the peak of the AC voltage. Okay? And then I'm going to plot current as a function of IC. And what we would see, of course, is that up until the point that this is 1, there's no voltage. And then when it reaches 1, it jumps up to a voltage. It would then continue as though it was a resistive device. Right? So that now we have electrons flowing. It'll then fall down if I decrease the voltage. So it'll be right on top of that. It'll go this way. So there'll be some hysteresis to this piece. And the hysteresis comes, you know, you think that that must be a nice quasi-particle piece. It's not. If I looked here, beginning the Josephson junction, already I would see hysteretic effects because in a ballistic case, electrons, the charge carriers, have mass. And so there's momentum. And the only thing that this is telling us is that the Cooper pairs have momentum, and so therefore they're going to remember their behavior for a while as you're going back. Okay? And if I was looking at a ballistic electronic system, it would turn quicker. All right. So now we're almost there. I take this differential equation, and what I want to do is I want to extract from it a potential so that we can say, oh, here's a potential, therefore we can find some eigenstates within that potential. And here, what we have is a system that I can extract the force from, and so I'll write down the force, and then I'll take negative the grad of the potential as a force, right? Okay, so we'll take minus du, and the reaction coordinate, of course, is the wave is the phase of the wave function. So it's okay. We just rearrange. Okay, so we have our force, we integrate the force, and the potential. I'm going to normalize the potential by the critical current. Remember, the critical current is just a number, right? So it just gives me a scale for the potential. Okay, so here's our potential as a function of our coordinate. And we plot this up. And so if I take IDC, to be 0, then we have a periodic potential in the phase. And what we would see, well, it's not that important actually, but what we would see is if we were looking at the physics of this device, that wrapping around 2 pi would be adding another Cooper pair. Doesn't matter too much. So now we have this nice cosine potential. So this is for IDC equals 0. And if I take pretend I can draw something smooth, IDC is equal to the critical current, then I have this tilted potential where it shouldn't ever go up, right? It's always going down. All right. Within this potential, we'll have a number of bound states. The difference between these bound states and these bound states is the addition of one Cooper pair. And so if I wanted to have a device where I was going to quantize to Cooper pairs, then I would say, oh yeah, I'm going to build a small island, collect my Cooper pairs there, and we can make quantum devices that live between these two wells, and my qubit lives in those two lowest states. If I want to have a device that depends upon the current in the ring, and thus the flux threading the ring, then I can live within one set of wells, and I can use my qubits between these two levels. Okay. If I tilt the potential, then at some point when I tilt the potential, As I tilt the potential, each of these levels will at some point fall out to the potential and go running in phase. And so then we'll have a piece that says d phi dt is equal to a constant, not zero. And then we can say, oh, that's good. I'll have a voltage across the device. And so by running down this way, we can measure. We can measure by finding a voltage across the Josephson junction. The separation of these two levels, of course, depends upon the quantization of this ring, which depends upon how big I make the ring. Okay, so all of that's under our control. Typically, these separations are gigahertz. And this becomes a very simple building block. Now, by itself, if I just make this device, it's not a great quantum device, because, you know, I've done something horrible. I've taken this classical noise source and stuck it across my quantum device. So I don't want to do that. And so instead of doing that, we end up putting a couple of Josephson junctions. So I can say, oh, well, I can control this phase over here. And so you build in a few rings. But those are details. Here we can make these nice devices. You can control them by voltage. You can control them by current. You can control them by the fluxes you add to them. And because the magnetic field that threads this is quantized, they're easy to link together. An old experiment by Hans Moy in Delft took rings of these. And demonstrated that you can condense them into a Mott insulator. And there we can say, oh yeah, we can make synthetic materials just out of patterning superconductors on a device. Okay. So if you look at the most recent work in this, the most recent work takes patterned strip lines of superconductor so that this length, these are capacitors, this length dictates a half wave. And now I can make a resonator out of this. And then next to this resonator, so it's a resonator, and the Q can be very high. The Q can be 100,000. Actually, the Q can be 1,000,000. And therefore, if the Q is high, the local magnetic field is high. And so I can take and put my qubits next to this resonator, but far away from each other. And so then, as I move the qubit frequency into resonance with the resonator, then I can take a photon from the qubit, put it into the resonator. I can move the qubit away, then I can take that same photon, and I can interact it with this, and now I can create conditional gates between these. And since these resonance structures, you can build more and more complex versions of them, and it's easy to tune their frequencies. You can arrange a system where you're moving a microwave photon through your system and storing it in these elements and using the whole structure to control to have conditional gates. Yep. Good. All right. So that's what I wanted to say. There's a number of good review articles. There's too many of them, maybe. There's a nice article by John Clark from Berkeley describing the state of the art a couple of years ago. Any questions on that before I change subjects? Sorry for having it so short. All right. So I wanted to put down on the board what I think is the most compelling open questions. And these are, of course, from an experimentalist point of view. I'm not going to talk about algorithms. And I think the biggest question of towards building actual devices is to connect the theories of fault tolerance to physics. The theories of fault tolerance are great. And of course, what they've told us is that if we can build certain noise models, and if quantum resources are given to us essentially for free, then we can make a fault-tolerant quantum computer. And so that's a tremendously powerful result. But now then we want to ask a little bit further. If we have our noise sources, and if adding qubits has a finite cost, can we still build a quantum computer that will allow us to look at large computations? And for that, we need to better understand control of open quantum systems. For closed systems, I think we know everything we need to know. And, you know, there's still some more engineering. But in terms of advancing physics, we know for controlling open quantum systems, we know a little bit, right? We know that we can always resort to error correction, and that if we resort to error correction, we can return an open system to a closed system, you know, at the cost of throwing away something. But it's a painful way to go. And we would like to find one, more efficient ways of doing quantum error correction, but also other solutions. And of course, decoherence-free subspaces, noiseless subsystems are examples, but there will be more. And related to this is, how do we count resources? If I think about control, it's easy to say, oh, I can do better with control. Just give me more time, give me more bandwidth, give me more power. But you're not going to be free to choose more of those, or even better, you know, give me a perfect qubit. There's lots of suggestions out there that I can take a noisy qubit and make it perfect by adding a bunch of perfect qubits. And then you say, well, maybe you should just use those to begin with. So, you know, we need to have some way of comparing different things, and so therefore some counting method. Yeah.
When you say talking about counting resources, do you intend doing that kind of thing within a resource theory framework?
I think so. So if I imagine classically looking at how well I can control a system, then if I have the power bandwidth product of some controller, that's how well I can control it. We don't have the same theory for quantum systems. And we know it's easy to show you can exceed that.
What would the free operations be?
What was that?
What would the free operations be if it was someone else else
there? I don't know. The You would think that the internal Hamiltonian would be that. Right. Yes. But, you know, maybe not. One of the things that's important is if you want your system to be stationary, usually that costs a lot of effort. And it's hard to imagine that's effort well spent, right? You just think, well, why couldn't I do my calculation in that frame? Why do I need to do it in this one? But I don't know yet. We need to deal with memory in the environment. Usually, we say, well, if information leaks into the environment, it'll be corrupted so much, it won't come back. But actually, experiments don't show that. And you don't, it's deadly to have an echo of your computation left behind somewhere. And so we don't know how important this is. We don't know how to deal with it. We don't have very good approaches. And if, sort of the comments up here, if I needed to make the environment behave stationary, if I needed to control the whole environment to make my quantum computer look good, then it's going to cost us a lot of effort. You know, clearly you can do it, but and methods to efficiently remove entropy. That might be a little bit too much engineering. But, you know, there needs to be a place where engineering and physics come together if we're going to build devices. And this we don't yet have. We need to verify our quantum process. And now we have a bunch of groups talking about having 100-qubit quantum computers. And you're going to be well challenged to demonstrate that you've done the right thing over a space at large. Even just to learn a Hamiltonian. And we and others have shown that, of course, you don't always need to know your Hamiltonian, all the terms. But you do need to be able to bound them, and there's a few terms it helps to know. And so learning might not be that I know every little thing to high precision. But I need to, there is a set of information I need to know. And we have to figure out what that is. We also need to learn the noise. Because we're going to need to be efficient in the removal of it. And so there are properties of it that's important. All of this looks like we can do quantum simulation. And you know, can we do it reliably? A separate question, which I think is really important for theorists, is what should you measure? If you want to demonstrate something, we often compare classical simulation of a quantum system with a quantum simulation. And then we'll say, oh, well, the quantum simulation is much easier, lives more compact. We don't have to store the whole bloody density matrix. We don't have to. But when, at the end of it, if I did the classical simulation of the quantum system, and if by some miracle it was small enough that I could store it, then at that point I would have a density matrix, and I'm free to ask any question I want. And I'm free to go back and ask another one. But of course, quantum mechanically, you're not. You know, you can ask a set of commuting observables. And which ones do you ask? We don't know that. We'd like to think that if we had a reliable quantum system, we could use it to improve our implementation of future quantum systems. That because of the inefficiency of doing this classically, then why should we do it classically? Let's just take a small processor. But we don't know how well to do that. And we end up doing things that say, if everything worked correctly, I'm going to look at this particular outcome, and it will be this state, usually the state we put in to begin with. And so that we can look for small changes. And that's easy to do. I'll be disappointed if that's the best thing you can do. Of course, you can't do a random thing. You know, you do a simulation, you make a measurement, and you do a simulation that should come to some point, but you just look out long in time. And what do you find? You find that you're in some orthogonal state. And unfortunately, there are a lot of orthogonal states in Hilbert space. And so you haven't learned anything. And so we need to come up with better ideas there. We're going to have small processors. We sort of do today. And there's lots of opportunities of using small processors for measurement. You know, there's a bunch of standard model physics. And just to go back to the neutron case, measuring the neutron electron dipole moment would be a lovely thing to do. And like a lot of standard model results, what we end up doing is making a series of measurements that says, well, okay, it's smaller than what we can see. And the variation from what we could do 20 years ago to what we can do today isn't big, right? We can add a digit or two. So it'd be nice to make a big change in the precision with which we're asking, in the sensitivity with which we're asking those questions. And of course, today there are at least two areas where we want to really make sensitive measurements to advanced physics. You know, not everything has been answered with this beautiful recent result about gravity waves. So we like to look and see. And of course, there's dark matter and energy. We'd like to know, we'd like to find it. And it would be surprising to me that quantum information couldn't play an important role in these devices. They all end up looking like interferometric measurements. And so, you know, we've built in some coherence, hopefully, to begin with. Now, of course, there's a lot of other things one can use small processors to measure, right? There's a goal of measuring three-dimensional structures of proteins. There's a goal of measuring subsurface effects in quantum materials. And all of those are fascinating, but you know, maybe these connect better. So that's my piece of the next, you know, the what I'm looking for over the next 4 years, you know, time enough for you guys to get a PhD and have solved these problems. So what did I leave off? What should also be there? Well, if you think of things, then send me an email. Let's get together and talk about them. And also, if you think that something's there that shouldn't be there, and you say, oh, this problem is not so exciting, and, you know, it's not going to lead to anything. You know, maybe the iffiest one is this one, But you know, we're devoting a big amount of work in the lab exactly to that, because might be more engineering than physics, but I think this is enabling of learning about the rest of it. One of the things we'd like to do, you know, if instead of this, I had said, let me tell you the grand problems, you know, what would be the most exciting result? Create an entanglement over distant objects and keep it for a long time and don't have it be a post-selected entanglement, right? Have it be a robust, entangled object over some distance. Take a qubit and be able to keep it coherent indefinitely. And both of those two, you know, keeping a qubit coherent indefinitely sort of opens up this avenue that says, oh, I can ask what happened over this long timeline. It's not quite like that, right? We're not doing time travel. But you know, it does say that the result that you would pick out from a measurement depends upon all of that. Yeah? And I think that those two are the grand experimental challenges facing us right now. And many groups are trying to do each of these. And these pieces give us a way of getting there. And of course, they're interesting in their own right. Okay, we'll stop here and hope to hear more from you. Take care.